When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Discourse, the show where we discuss film news, reviews, or any other thing in the pop culture zeitgeist that we feel the need to weigh in on. I'm Ryan Oliver, and today with me I have a special guest, a returning guest, possibly the best guest. She is the director of programming for the Austin Asian American Film Festival, as well as a contributor to the Austin Chronicle. Jenny Nolf, welcome back to The Discourse.
Hi! I didn't realize I was the best. I'm going to tell everyone else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's you could tell everybody else, but if they're listening, then you know they already heard it.
That's true.
But you know, it's always a great conversation having you on here. So really appreciate you taking the time. And to our listeners, apologies for there not being an episode for the last month. I did mention, I believe it was our Luce Nightingale episode. I did mention that my wife and I were expecting our first kid. He did show up on September 5th, and so because of that, I've just been, it's been a hard time getting to showings and a hard time, you know, getting guests and wrangling the podcast together, so we took a belated break. Fortunately, we've still had a lot of strong content on the Playlist Podcast feed, for courtesy of B-Real and the Fourth Wall Podcast, so awesome work, you guys. Thank you for picking up the slack while I've been out. But today we have a lot to discuss. We're going to be talking a little bit about fall festival stuff. We're going to be talking about the movies in September that was missed on this show. We'll be talking about Takashi Miike's latest film, First Love, as well as It Chapter 2, Hustlers, and a bunch more. But a couple things, a couple pieces of housekeeping to get out of the way before we get started. As usual, The Discourse is a part of the Playlist Podcast Network, so if you enjoy this show, be sure to subscribe to us via your podcatcher of choice, be it Stitcher, be it SoundCloud, Anchor FM, Spotify, or iHeartRadio, which we are now on, and you'll get this show as well as our other programs, including Be Real, Indie Beat, The Fourth Wall, or any of the other various things that pop up on the feed from time to time. And then the other order of business we have to get out of the way, regrettably, for those who don't know, I am in a fantasy football league with a bunch of our colleagues, a bunch of other film critics, film journalists, a fair amount of people who have actually been on this show before, including Robert Daniels, Alicia Grosso, Matt Donato, Matthew Monagle, and Griffin Schiller, the host of the Fourth Wall podcast over here on the Playlist Podcast Network. And him and I played each other in week one, and we made a side bet that whoever won would have to force the loser to watch something or some things of their choice and have to come on the podcast network to talk about it. And as you could probably tell in the tone of my voice, I lost. So Griffin forced me to watch the two Ghost Rider movies. That is 2007's Ghost Rider and 2012's Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance. Two movies I had seen before, but had not seen them since they played in their respective theatrical runs. And, I mean, TLDR, they're terrible. Like, they were terrible then, and they're terrible now. Jenny, did you ever see either of these movies?
No. Does that surprise you?
It doesn't, no. And you're a smarter person than I. I'll give myself a little bit of a pass for seeing the first one back in 2007. I've probably talked at length both to you off mic and on the show that I grew up in a pretty small town and we only had one movie theater, a single screen movie theater. And so once I was able to drive, I pretty much went and saw everything that came out to that theater. And Ghost Rider was one of those movies, so I went on a solo date to go see that. It was not good, and I was at least kind of maybe looking forward to revisiting the second one because it is directed by Neville Dean and Taylor, the guys who did Crank and Gamer. So I was at least like, oh, okay, there's some like crazy action, you know, I've kind of grown to appreciate their movies, in the time since. So I'm like, oh, maybe I missed something with that one. It, not really. There's some like kind of crazy action to it, but it's just super bland and it looks really cheap, like shockingly cheap. And I know it was like half the budget of the first one, but it just looks like, I don't know, it looks like it was shot on a GoPro. Like, it just doesn't look very good, and it's worst of all, they're just boring movies, so. But a bet's a bet. I'm a man of my word. Griffin forced me to watch them, so I did, and I'm here to say, if you haven't revisited those movies in a while, or you haven't seen them at all, just don't. And better and better yet, don't. If you don't play fantasy football, also don't, because it's a hellscape on Earth every single Sunday, I swear to God. But enough about that. Let's move on to some like news slash other film related items. It is, I guess, probably the biggest thing that has occurred in this podcast's absence is fall festival season is. You know, it's a mad dash for the awards this year. Jenny and I were just talking on my off mic briefly that that the Oscars are earlier this year, about 3 weeks to a month earlier. It's on February 9th. So it seems like all the deadlines have been pushed up a month. And so just title after title, it seems like at Venice, at TIFF and Fantastic Fest, that they just unveiled all these potential Oscar contenders. So I'm going to pass the ball to you, Jenny, because, I know neither of us were at Venice or TIFF, but you were at Fantastic Fest. Yeah, I wish too.
Not so much TIFF. I really want to go to Venice someday.
I do too. And we'll definitely be talking about that a little bit on the next episode of this podcast, which I'll talk about at the end here. But you were at Fantastic Fest. It was the 15th annual Fantastic Fest, and I believe it was your 11th that you've gone to.
Close. It's my 10th. So I've been going since 2008, but I had to skip 2 years because I was really poor and not yet a film critic. So
that's fair.
So it's my 10th. I actually counted this year. And yeah, I've been going for a long time.
And how was it this year?
You know, I honestly feel like the programming wasn't as good as years past. And I mean, that's not the fault of the festival. That's mostly the fault of movies coming out and what you're able to like access. I feel like this also they've run into this issue of streaming because, and I think a lot of festivals have too, where a lot of these films that used to premiere at like a Fantastic Fest or something like that, that were smaller, now get picked up for streaming a lot faster.
Yeah.
So there's less of a festival run for some of these really good underground horror movies because a lot of these people want to make money and they don't want to wait, which I understand completely. I also think there's a lot more genre festivals out there than there used to be. So Fantastic Fest gets a lot of second run stuff now and third run stuff, mostly second run from TIFF. So programming was off, but like the good stuff was really good. But you also kind of knew going in that that good stuff was good. The only surprise I had was this movie called The Vast of Night, which is an Amazon release, actually, Ryan.
Okay.
Yeah, and I loved it. It's a sci-fi movie set in, I think it's the 1950s, of a small, it's supposed to be a New Mexico town. Well, it is a New Mexico town in the movie, but it's actually filmed in Texas, which is kind of nice. And strange Twilight Zone-y things start happening in it. I loved it.
That's awesome. No, I've heard nothing but great things about The Vast of Night, and I'm really, really excited to check that movie out. And I do agree that it is, you know, even outside looking in, because I wasn't able to attend the festival this year, that, you know, there is a lot of holdover from TIFF, and because of that, you know, a lot of those movies, the window is either shrinking or the, you know, like you said, Netflix. I mean, like, for example, I know the new Jim Mickle film played there, right, In the Shadow of the Moon.
Right, they have a really good relationship with Netflix.
That makes sense, because that movie's already on Netflix right now for people to watch. The Tall Grass, the Stephen King adaptation.
Not a good movie.
Yeah, I remember you seeing your Letterboxd review of that movie, but neither here nor there. It's out tomorrow, I believe, on Netflix.
I think you're right,
So,
and then Dolomite played there as a quote-unquote secret screening.
Right, which is out. That's Netflix, I think, the 25th, but it starts its theatrical run tomorrow at the time of this recording.
Yeah. I can't remember. I think there's a few other Netflix movies. Oh, Fractured, which is a really bad movie that I watched.
Oh, that's a bummer.
It's by the director of Session 9, who's actually a good director, I think. It's just the script was really bad.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
And it stars, I believe, one of your favorite actors. Well, maybe not. It's the actor from See for Zachariah, except I can't remember his name at the moment.
Oh, is it Chiwetel Ejiofor?
No.
See
for Zachariah. I mean, Lost City of Z.
Oh.
So many Z's are Zed.
Robert Pattinson?
No. The main guy.
Oh,
Lost
Charlie
City
Hunnam?
Yeah, Charlie Hunnam's in it.
Oh, okay.
Is it him? Oh my god, all those like buff white guys from Australia look the same.
They do, and I mean, I'm not going to, like, you know, I like him in Lost City of Zed. I'll say that for sure.
But you're not going to go to bat for him either?
Nah, I mean, you know.
I know your opinions on these things. Oh, no, actually. Oh, it's even worse. I'm so sorry. I feel bad for Charlie Hunnam. It's Sam Worthington.
Oh, I heard of this movie. Oh, man.
It doesn't seem right to me because at least I feel like he's good.
Yeah.
It's bad.
Yeah, I heard pretty rough things about that movie. That was sort of maybe the again, outside looking in, maybe the most disappointing thing it seems like people had coming out of that festival, because Session 9 is so beloved and people were very excited about this movie, and the enthusiasm sort of deflated as people walked out of that showing.
Yeah, and I don't really blame I think his name's Brad Anderson, the director. Don't really blame him, because it looks nice, but it's just not good. And he didn't write it, so, I mean, that's why I feel like I can't really blame him. It just feels like he's so gun for hire here.
That's unfortunate, so that's a bummer. But that happens, right? I mean, it's you know, maybe their fault, maybe not, but whatever the case, the alchemy for it just didn't work out.
Yeah. But, I mean, as far as I mentioned The Fast of Night, I also saw Parasite, which I loved.
I can't wait to see it.
Oh, my God. I feel like everyone should have this at the top of their most anticipated list. I feel like, you know, my co-host over at No Excuses, Mike, doesn't like Bong Joon-ho that much, and he even really gelled with this movie. So I feel like this is, if you haven't gelled with Korean cinema very much in the past, and there's some people that just don't because they're editing and stylization and themes are a little bit, sometimes doesn't work with people and it's just not for them. But I feel like this is like maybe his most mainstream, awards worthy kind of film.
That's awesome. No, I've heard like pretty much unanimously across the board that this movie is, you know, I'm always get leery when the word masterpiece is thrown around, but it does seem unanimous, even from people who tend to be less hyperbolic than others. So that has me pretty excited.
Yeah, so that one was really good. I also really enjoyed, I'm trying to think back now, it's really hard. Oh, Swallow, which is an IFC film. I don't know if it's IFC Midnight or just IFC, but it's a thriller. I would say it's just IFC. It's a thriller, and it goes places that it's surprisingly funny, but tender. And it really takes the film in a direction. It's about a housewife who starts to swallow items that are very unconventional.
Interesting.
At home once
okay.
She gets pregnant. And it comes from a really tender place, I think, which is shocking because it can be really, really funny and really cynical, but then on a switch, it will be understanding and heartfelt, and the ending kind of comes together in this weird way that is really gutsy. I don't want to give a lot away, and I feel like this movie hasn't gotten a lot of festival buzz, because a lot of people have like liked it, but I felt like I found some like-minded people at Fantastic Fest that just really gelled with this movie like I did and really liked it. So I think that it is kind of like an underrated festival film right now.
Nice. That's
that should be coming out anytime soon because IFC has it
for sure, and they think they also had what's the movie, Knives and Skin, the Jennifer Reeder film that also played, which I think is coming out pretty soon here as well. So if it's IFC, yeah, I imagine they're going to give it a release here shortly.
Yeah, but that was, I think, IFC Midnight. I think Swallow is actually just straight up IFC.
Okay.
And then a few others before we go on to the one that we both have seen. I think also St. Maud is interesting, but I think way overhyped out of the festival circuit.
Interesting. I wanted to ask you about that one, because that seems to be one of the more hotter titles that came from that festival.
So for me, the second act just did not work at all.
Interesting.
It was really slow, and these two characters that you are with in the first act, it distances them a lot in the second, and I don't think it brings them together in time for me to feel like it was a really fully fleshed out and completed thought, almost. Because it's one of those films where it has one idea it's trying to sell you, and just the longer it goes on, it's like, okay, well, I get it. But also, it juggled some people. But I just felt it was too slow, and the second act was just too much of a misstep.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Yeah, well, it was really a bummer because most of the movies I saw either was like fine or I didn't like. So, which is really rare at a Fantastic Fest. I feel like I usually have a good mix. This is the first year I like consistently, I felt like, rated things like 2 and 2.5 stars every time I left.
Yeah, I did. I was following you and a fair amount of other peers' Letterboxd pages and their reviews that they were doing the festival, and I did remember consistently yours being like a little on the lower end, which, you know, it happens.
Yeah, and I did the thing this year, which I haven't done for a while or ever, because I've had Letterboxd hasn't been around for a bit, is I sat on movies for about 24 hours before I rated them, so I actually like didn't like immediately rate them. So some of them I rated them a little bit higher than I would have even walking out, which is not saying much when 2.5 is, I'm like, yeah, that's not really a 2. It's a 2.5.
And that's smart.
Or that's not really a 2.5. That's a 3.
That's smart. And I mentioned that on, I believe it was our Once Upon a Time in Hollywood episode, that I said, you know, don't tweet immediately after the movie. Like, I tell myself to not do that, because then you regret it, because on either end, whether you are way hyped on it and then it dies down, or you were very cold on it, and then you think about it, and you go, oh, wait a minute, no, I actually really, really liked that movie more than I thought coming out of it. So, you know, it's. I think that's a smart way to go, is to hold on to it for a little bit.
Yeah, because I feel like with Fest, for me, I do get Fest hype as well.
It's a thing.
But I also, it is a thing, but also I feel like I tend to judge movies harsher if I don't like them. It's like, it goes both ways.
Oh, sure.
But I don't know. The only one that I was like, oh, I was too generous to, was Fractured.
Okay.
After getting out of it, where I was like, oh, 2 is really generous to that movie. And I bumped it down.
It definitely happens. But that's smart, because Fest hype is a real thing. Like, you know, you get in that bubble, you're there with people who are excited to be watching a movie, and that can be definitely infectious, or it could, like you said, could work against you, where if people are digging it, and then it's like you fight back harder if you aren't liking it, even if the movie's just fine. So
yeah,
no, I understand that wholeheartedly.
But there is one movie you have seen now.
I have.
A lot of these movies oddly had a very quick release date after Fantastic Fest.
Well, they did. I mean, it isn't just the movie. I mean, we're going to be talking about this particular movie in full, but like, there's a handful of movies that I have seen already that either from another festival or screener links or screenings, you know, like I've already seen Knives and Skin, Kokodi Kokodai, Bliss, Dolomite is My Name. But we
have. Yeah, you've seen a lot more than I have. Like, I haven't even seen Bliss. I probably never will see Bliss. Sorry.
No, yeah, it's okay. No comment. But we have both seen First Love, which is the latest film from Takashi Miike, and you are right. It pretty much immediately, it played TIFF, and then it played Fantastic Fest, and then it hit limited release on September
27th. Which I think was actually smart for Waldo to do to hype up this film, because and Miike is an interesting director where he has made like over 100 films, is really well known, but I don't think his films in the U.S. have ever really financially worked.
So, not during, I was going to say, not, like, during their run. You know, like movies like Audition and Ichi the Killer probably later have.
Like, on DVD and Blu-ray releases, yes. I feel like, more than theatrical. I'm going to actually look it up while we talk about the film, but I don't know what his most successful financially is.
I would have to imagine, maybe because, he's grown in stature over the years because of those aforementioned movies via DVD and Blu-ray. I would have to imagine it was Blade of the Immortal, potentially.
That's what I'm thinking.
Just because, well, it was, I think, wasn't it, A, it was Magnet who put it out. So, like, that had a, I think they had a little bit more, I mean, it played theaters. I saw it in a theater. And then they also made sort of a big deal because it was his 100th movie. So that was kind of, I think, one of the hooks to going to it. It was like, it's Takashi Miike's 100th movie. So I think that probably boosted a little bit, but I have no idea.
Well, that movie didn't make very much. It made $150,000.
Oh, no. Okay. It was far less than I thought.
So I think Miike has kind of, like, run into this issue where I think a lot of, like, foreign films do this. They just struggle finding their audience a little bit theatrically, but they find a really good home video audience.
Absolutely. And that's one thing too that I kind of love, and I love about Wellgo too, is like, they're one of the few, like, smaller labels that you'll see their title show up at, like, a big box store anymore. Like you would think that you'd have to order that on Amazon or through, like, a boutique distributor, but, like, you could actually go to a Target and see, like, I think that's where I bought my copy of The Wailing, like, a couple years ago, because Wellgo put that out. Like, it's something that's nice, for sure.
So I'm looking at it now, and it looks like their most financially successful film, box office-wise, at $800,000.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so that makes sense. His audience is niche for those who, like, show up to the movie theater, but his movies do tend to do well, like, far after the fact.
Yeah.
But yeah, so First Love is his latest film. It's like his 104th, 105th movie, something like that. I don't know. He somehow made 5 movies in between Blade of the Immortal and this, which is the last movie of his I saw.
It's his 103rd film.
103rd. Okay, so he made 2 movies in between this and Blade of the Immortal. Okay. Yes. I was partially being sarcastic. I mean, I love the guy's movies, mostly. I didn't like Blade of the Immortal very much, but I traditionally go for his movies. It is his latest. It's kind of it's like a crime comedy romance, a little bit of True Romance meets After Hours, I would say. But I'll pass it to you. You were fortunate enough to see it in the theater, which, I mean, I guess it is expanding to Seattle this weekend, so I could go see it in the theater if I wanted to, but... I'll pass it to you. What did you think of Miike's latest?
I thought it was fine. I thought it was a lot of fun. And I think that in this kind of context, since he's not really trying to say much, which to me, a lot of the Miike I'm familiar with is a lot of his earlier work, where it's a lot of genre, it's a lot of gore, and it's a lot of... there's a lot of things going on within the context of the film that he's trying to say something at the end of the day, whether it be like an audition where he's trying to say something about men and how they look for another partner, or if it's something like Mr. Q, which I recently watched, which is trying to say a lot about Japanese culture and especially like how far you can push boundaries in a pink film and like at the end of the day still have to like scrub out the genitalia. It's so bizarre. And then this one, after watching a bunch of these films recently, it just kind of fell flat for me on that end, but I think it's a lot of fun. And I would actually argue that there is no romance in this film outside the romances. Like I would say that there's not a romance between the male and the female.
Yeah, it does, like, I was just reading the, like, genres that it said. It does say, like, crime, comedy, romance. And it does, like, the movie True Romance in a way, just from, like, a, you know, street-level people end up in extraordinary situations, and just one of them's male, one of them's female. But I would agree that I don't think there's too much of a, like, there's not really a love connection barriers.
Right. And I think the end they try to kind of be like, well, maybe they're together, which I don't ever like that kind of like, will they, won't they? You can't tell if it's friendly or if they're living together because they're in love. But I never got that vibe. And I feel like the first love of this film is each character has, I mean, there are some characters that are romantically involved with people, but like the two main characters, which their names are over my head right now, the boxer and then the sex worker. The sex worker is focused on kind of like having this past trauma with her dad. And her first love was this guy in high school who saved her from her dad. Versus like the boxer's first love is boxing. That's kind of how I saw it a little bit, which I thought was a nice new and different change to these kinds of films when like a female and a male kind of get caught up in something that they didn't need to get caught up in.
To be honest, like I, you know, not to, you know, really spoil anything for people, but I think that was a nice refreshing approach, and that the movie sort of ultimately is about, like, I mean, that for their first love and just about sort of like overcoming the situations they are, or like overcoming the situations they're in, as opposed to like, as opposed to using one another to do that. They sort of like somehow come to these reconciliations together, but I hope, I don't know if I'm explaining that correctly, but it just doesn't, like, it's nice that it's like they need each other, or they didn't need each other to come to these reconciliations. It just happens that their paths cross, and that was you know, something that was unique to this type of movie.
Yeah, and so what was your favorite character? Because this is kind of like an ensemble
film. I would say my favorite character, and I forget the characters' names. I feel bad. I know Leo is the name of the boxer. That I do remember. But
it's Monica or Michelle. I think it's Monica is the sex worker.
Monica, but I believe it's. I think the character's name is Julie. The like,
oh, the woman,
assassin woman.
Yeah
she was my favorite, because that was like the, I feel like the biggest source of comedy to me, or like the most like sort of wacky, where like violence meets slapstick, is this just like almost seemingly unkillable Terminator-esque character. And right. I found that to be amusing overall, for sure.
Not even a dog bomb can get her.
No, not that's a really, like, I love that sequence. That and then the sort of like where it all coalesces at this sporting goods store are two of my favorite sequences of the movie. But no, that character I really enjoyed, and I enjoyed, like you said, like he usually has something to say, or it's like the Dead or Alive movies that are super super over the top crazy.
Right. Yeah,
and so like I kind of liked that this one was like kind of in the vein of that gangster movie, but it was a little bit more restrained, and I think that actually helps the movie, because when it gets crazy, it can be really really fun, but it also makes it really difficult to care about what's going on. And it was nice to really care about these characters' journey without, like you said, without that sort of like, he doesn't have like a grander statement he's trying to make with it. He's just making a like fun crime mob movie.
Yeah, which, I mean, it's fun, and it's not actually a bad movie. It's just in the scope of things that I like from him, this is not necessarily what I like from him as much. But it was a nice, fun time at the movie, which I feel like is really rare to get. Just like a solid, like 2 hour action packed, funny, and interesting film.
Yeah, and it's like, and it's one of those nice examples of like, you know, the opposite, the nice like medium in fest hype, like what we were just talking about, of like not everything you see at a fest or in general throughout the year, not everything has to blow the doors down. Like it doesn't have, like you can see a movie that's like this, that's just perfectly solid throughout the entire way. It doesn't like reinvent the wheel. It isn't like the best movie the filmmaker's ever done, but it's just really solid and really fun to watch.
Yeah. And I wish, see, this is why I usually like Fantastic Fest, because I feel like First Love is like a staple kind of film that you find there, where you find these really great films sometimes that are kind of diamonds in the rough. Like when I saw Coherence there, but then you'll also like see some really bad stuff. But in between, most of the in between is this solid kind of fun time at the movies. And I just felt like this year at Fantastic Fest, it just didn't have that vibe outside of First Love.
Well, that's both a bummer, but I'm glad that at least if it happened at least once in something like First Love.
Yeah, which I mean, I could have expected from Mike that he wouldn't give me a bad film that I walked out going, wow, that was terrible. Wish I didn't see that.
Yeah, he's rarely done that. I think for me, the closest would be like Blade of the Immortal. And even then, I didn't think it was terrible. I was just like, wow, that was really repetitive. And why is it 2 hours and 20 minutes? But that's about all the only bad I really had to say about that one.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even see that one. It just didn't appeal to me.
you didn't see Blade of the Immortal. Yeah. You don't have to. Like, you've seen, you've seen 13 Assassins, right?
Yeah, no. Actually, I haven't watched a lot of his newer, like, Yakuza crime stuff like this.
I would, both are more like a how do you pronounce it? I always fuck it up. Wuxia?
Oh, Wuxia, yeah.
Wuxia, yeah. That's basically both 13 Assassins and Blade of the Immortal, but 13 Assassins is the one to watch if you're going to watch one.
Okay.
I recommend that one. Blade of the Immortal's like, it's good for like 30 minutes and then like you realize, oh man, this is just going to be really, really repetitive throughout the movie. And it's longer than it needs to be, for sure.
I see. Yeah.
Well, any other thoughts on First Love before we sort of quick hit the films in September?
No, I think that covers it. Unless you have anything more to say.
No, I don't. I literally just finished watching it before we hopped on mic here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. But I enjoyed it. Like, you know, it's like you said, it's a solid movie and it doesn't have to be anything more. And I definitely recommend people seek it out. If it plays at a theater near you, or, you know, it'll likely be on VOD sooner rather than later. So I would recommend it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of solid movies that are longer than they need to be, that was bad. I should cut that out, but I'll probably just work through it.
Oh, no.
So starting in September, starting from the front of September, was, I guess, the first big movie of September and the highest grossing movie of September, was It Chapter Two, which we were going to do a full episode on, back when it came out. But as I mentioned, my son was born the day after I saw the movie. So it just the episode never came to fruition. But even though I do stand by thinking that this movie is entirely too long and occasionally repetitive, not to bury the lead, but you and I both liked this movie, and I'm shocked that ends up, that's like a controversial stance to take with this movie.
Yeah, I mean, we like it fine.
Yeah, well, I don't know if controversial is the right word, but I'm not to review reviews, but I'm kind of shocked a little at the like mixed response to this movie compared to the first one. Cause I don't know about you, but I left this movie going like most of the strengths and weaknesses of the first film persist here. And they're just very much of a piece to me. So I was just very shocked of how one was received so, so well over the second chapter.
It did surprise me too, because I feel like I don't know what people wanted with this one. And I understand because it is repetitive. And there's this part in the second act where you're just like, okay,
yes,
I get it. I feel like I watched all this in the first movie. But I also see from an adaptation standpoint where essentially what they did was they basically made what the entire film would have been if it had just been one film.
Yeah, it's essentially structured like the miniseries. The 1990 miniseries. Like, it's almost like that movie remade, but you got a whole first chapter of the kids before it.
Yeah, which is, I don't know if we necessarily needed every kid going out and having their own adventure. Maybe they could have done with, like, cutting out three of those kids and keeping a huge focus on the Richie character, which was played by Bill Hader as an adult. Because I feel like that permeated a lot through this film, and I feel like there are some very wrong takes in this on the line for this film. One being that shocked me was someone calling it Chapter Two homophobic, which I 100% disagree on. I think that it's almost it not even almost, it's the opposite, where it's trying to show people that this stuff still happens, and it's a horror movie on top of it. So yes, it's really disturbing to see some of this stuff, but that doesn't mean it's homophobic if someone gets beaten up at the beginning of the movie,
Agreed.
like killed, because and said like it's about how bully be like it's about bullying and that culture and how it takes these marginalized people and just wears them down.
I think maybe, and granted, I haven't read too much into that take. The only counter argument, and I still don't think it would be sound, but the only counter argument I could think of, because that opening scene of this movie is the same opening scene from the book. It is straight from the pages of the book.
Right,
But
yeah.
because the present day of the book was in the mid-80s, and the kid version was in the 50s, and it was like during the height of the AIDS epidemic, I could see somebody making that argument, but that's to me, that's not what the movie's about or what the book is about. It's about the perpetual cycle of these things continuing to happen. And it's about the cycle of like these small towns, about how people haven't progressed and people haven't moved on. And these things still happen. So I would believe in 2019, in a tiny town like Derry, that something like that would happen, sadly. And
Yeah, a hate
so
crime like that could happen. I feel like hate crimes like that still happen.
they do. And so to me, I'm like, no, this doesn't, it doesn't ring homophobic. It doesn't ring false. I think it fits squarely into what the story is ultimately about. And even driven further by the fact of Richie's aforementioned arc, which I guess, maybe I'll keep mum. It is still out in theaters, but, I think that's really strong stuff, to be honest. I didn't think it was like exploitative or homophobic in any way. Yeah, no, I definitely don't agree with that take. Like I kind of mentioned at the top, my biggest issues with the movie really is just that second act and how the structure of it gets super repetitive. And you're like, okay, I get it. Like, yes, I love all these characters. I like hanging out with them, but I get it. Let's move on.
I
But
mean, I
that's
feel
about
like I
it.
really didn't need a second act of hanging out with the kid, mo all the kids again. Some of the kids, I think it's worth revisiting, especially like Richie's character, and maybe even the character. Oh God, I can't remember his name. The one who doesn't live. Stan? Is it Stan? Yes. Maybe.
Yes. No, no, no.
Yes.
Yes, I don't. Yes, it is Stan. I don't know
Yeah.
why I forgot his name, but yes, you're correct.
Yeah, like I understand, like kind of revisiting him because he kind of fits into Richie's segment, as well as what's his, oh my God, why am I forgetting names? Eddie.
Oh, yes,
I
Eddie.
understand, like maybe if you're gonna like focus on like this kind of arc in a film, I mean I understand then also Bev being there, but. Do we really need to see Bev and get reminded that she was beaten as a
No, I mean
child?
we know that. And also it's shown in the first scene of the movie. Like the first act of this movie sets up everything so well in terms of like how their trauma has enforced their adult life. We just see those like brief snippets, and so it's like we get that. And so it didn't need to be hammered home later in the movie because we already know that that is the case.
Right, so I feel like when you send all these characters off to go on their like treasure hunt, you didn't have the ones that didn't have much to say to go back in time with. They could have come back easily, and you could have cut those things. Where I feel like the only one that really brought some light to the situation was Richie, and then some heaviness was Stan because Stan was dead.
Right.
And it's kind of a nice moment to go back in time and see him alive, but kind of all remembering that. So I guess that's where I kind of stood with that, and that's like the part that weighed the movie down. But otherwise, I thought the movie was really ambitious, and a lot of it, like in the first and second act, or the first and third act, I liked.
Yeah, I loved, well, I mean, maybe love would be too strong a word, but like I really liked the first first and third acts of this movie. I think they're very, very strong. And there's good stuff in the second act for sure. It's just that's where it gets a little bit wonky and makes the movie a little bit overlong. But then it kind of comes back in the third movie and or third movie, Jesus Christ, third yep. act, and really like ties it together. So no, I liked it, and I look forward to like when the book cut eventually comes out. Like I'll be interested to see how they do that.
Yeah, I think my only thing that people didn't like this movie was because in the third act, it doesn't go as crazy bonkers as Stephen King's book does.
Right.
And I think a lot of people sometimes don't know how to detach their feelings for material and move forward. And also, I feel like if you hadn't read the books and you expected something more, there's this tough spot. And I think there's a lot of people who are willing to judge this film a lot more than they had this first one.
I agree. Yeah, and I think that's, well, and I think the, maybe because the first one came with little expectation, and then was, you know, ultimately well received, that sort of enforced people's sort of anticipation for this one, and for whatever reason they felt let down by it. But I mean, I don't think that's the proper way to go into a movie. I just think that that's what happened.
I think you're right.
For sure. But yeah, no, I liked the movie, and yeah, I'm like I said, I felt it was like a piece of the first and was just very, very shocked at like some of the negative reactions out there for it. But
I know, because we're usually the ones that are negative about horror movies.
Well, especially like big mainstream ones like that, you know, like,
yeah, that, like okay, you're trying to tell me that the new Annabelle movie was better than It Chapter 2? I mean, no. Go take a hike.
Yes, I agree. I agree with that wholeheartedly. Yeah, it is kind of funny. It is weird being on the defensive, but for positive reasons, as opposed to negative reasons, for sure. Do you have any other thoughts on It, or should we move on to Hustlers?
Oh, we can move on to Hustlers.
Let's move on to Hustlers, because this, like, even though It Chapter 2 is the highest grossing movie of September, Hustlers is probably the biggest surprise, and maybe the most lucrative overall because of its budget. I don't know about you, this movie really surprised the hell out of me. I didn't know much about it going into it. I didn't see a trailer. I didn't know it was based on a true story.
Mm.
I didn't know, like, I knew nothing about it. Wow. I just knew, like, I saw comedy in it, and I saw, like, STX put it out, and, like, this is probably, like, totally, totally unfair, but I thought it was, you know, something like Bad Moms. Like, again, no context. I did not read anything about it.
I mean, I can understand like that if you didn't know anything. Like, but just knowing the facts.
Yes, but, like, then finding out what it was about, seeing people's praises about it, I'm like, oh, okay, this sounds like something I really want to see. And I did get to go see it, and I thought it was really entertaining.
It is really entertaining. Yeah, what a nice movie to watch in September, or end of August. I can't remember. The month has been so long. But to me, Hustlers was kind of a surprise, because I didn't think it was going to be very good either.
Yeah, and I had no expectation for it. I just was like, I thought it was just going to be like a bad, like, R-rated comedy. I mean, right. And it's a comedy in a way, but it's like it's a little bit of true crime. It's definitely a little, like, you know, there's a lot of Scorsese-isms in the movie. I don't want to, like, take away from what Lorraine Scafaria, like, has done here, but, like, there's definitely a lot of, like, Steadicam and freeze frame, voiceover, dolly it, like, you know, a lot of the tools in Scorsese's toolbox. So that was pretty evident.
I read in an interview with her that they originally did offer the film to him. So really? Clearly they had plans to make this film like a Scorsese film.
Well, I think they did mostly successful. It feels, you know, it feels of a piece with something like Casino and Goodfellas. I think both Jennifer Lopez and Constance Wu are outstanding in this movie. Jennifer Lopez, especially.
Jennifer Lopez is really good.
She's so good. Like, it's one of those performances where, like, I love a performance where when they walk on screen for the first time in the movie, that you go, they're going to command this thing. And she definitely does that. Like, there's just such a presence that it's like, oh man, she's going to take control of this whole movie. And she kind of does. Yeah, she does for the most part. I mean, everything, most of the actions, you know, revolve around her character. And the one thing, and I mean, I guess maybe spoilers for real life, mildly. I'm not going to, like, dive too into it. But what I did like about this movie, as opposed to something like Goodfellas and Casino, which you don't see in this type of movie very often, is how the downfall, like, there is an inevitable downfall to what's happening to the characters in this movie, with the law, but there isn't as much of a downfall in, like, relationships. And I thought that was really refreshing, because it's like, you know, the end of Goodfellas, it's like, okay, Henry Hill rats everybody out and he's in witness protection, and then, like, you know, he's all alone. And so, like, I like that, you know, there was such a camaraderie with these people that even though, like, yeah, their hustle had to come to an end, but their relationships are kind of left to be rekindled. And so I thought that was, like, a nice, I mean, if it's real life, it's real life, but it's still a nice touch for this kind of movie.
It is a nice touch. I do like how you see, like, when they do have that kind of falling out with their relationships, there's an understanding as well. It's not, yes, like with animosity. It has to do with protecting yourself. And more or less, because these are all women who are also mothers, it's protecting their children. Or at least the two main characters, Constance Wu's character and J Lo's character, are both mothers.
Right.
And so there's, like, this kind of unique understanding between women there. And there's a bit where I think Constance Wu's character doesn't believe that J Lo's character really felt anything for her, but then it all kind of comes in the end, and she realizes that the story that she has kind of made up in her mind actually isn't real.
Right.
Which I liked. I don't know how much I liked the wraparound of the journal, like, journalist.
Yeah, I was wondering about that also, because that device, well, I mean, I guess it doesn't happen too much in, like, these type of movies, but I was thinking, like, that seems to happen a lot, where it's like, these sort of bio, like, these type of, like, biopics that are framed, you know, because they're based on a journalist's interaction with somebody. Like, I think of, what's the David Foster Wallace one? The End of the Tour.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, or the upcoming Mr. Rogers one, Beautiful Day, right, in the Neighborhood, apparently has that same, like, plot device also. And it's sort of like, yeah, I think you could have just done the way that, like, something like Casino is, where it's just voiceover from different perspectives, where you don't have, like, that framing device, but it's like you have the narration of, like, what's happening at any given time. And I don't think it would have taken away from the movie if they went that route.
No, I don't either. And I feel like it almost takes you out of the moment when you go back to Constance Wu and Julia Stiles' interview. Because the movie has so much momentum, especially in the first and second acts.
Absolutely.
Particularly in the first act, where you have, like, these four women who are, for lack of better words, at the top of my head, hustling to make a living and to have a stable lifestyle. But, and even at the end of the day, like, you see into these ladies' apartments, and they're not, like, living in a mansion somewhere in upstate New York. They're living in an apartment that is, like, as big as the one that I lived in Austin, maybe.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, they're just trying to get by.
And trying to be comfortable.
Exactly. Which I think is, you know, I think that's the other, like, strength of the movie, too, is because, like, the, you know, not to keep comparing and contrasting it to, like, the other movies I mentioned, but, like, there's a sense of greed that sips into those movies, and it is like really, really lush lifestyles that are depicted in those films, which leads to more greed, which leads to greater downfall. And, like, I think it's just super relatable that, you know, these characters are doing it because they have to, and I think, you know, it happening shortly after the economy tanked in 2008, and I think, like, I can't think of a movie. I mean, because there's been movies like Margin Call that like have like gone into like what happened about that. But to see a movie like from the ground level about that, like the only other movie I could think of, which they're totally tonally different, other than they're both kind of crime movies, is Killing Them Softly. Did you ever see that?
No, I didn't.
The Andrew Dominik film. It's good. It's really fucking like nihilistic and bitter. It's totally different from this type of movie. But like, I thought of that in terms of like, okay, here's what happened to the people on the ground after the economic crash. Here's what happened. Like, here's the trickle down effect that led to this. And I know, I think that's really strong in this movie.
Yeah, I actually think so too. It's really interesting because one of the things I came out with is how distinct the music changes in the film. And I never thought about how, like, what was popular before or after the crash, but there's like this like sense of like wealth and like partying in the music for the first like half, like the Usher song comes to mind. Oh, where yeah. Everyone's like out and enjoying themselves and they're spending as much as they can. And then there's like the post 2008 party song, which is not yet sad, because that I feel like is in the more in the 2010s, like in the mid 2010s, you get like these like sad party anthems, much like Lord, which she plays at the end. But then right. You get these like weird, like joyously, like almost empty happy songs. Don't have the same momentum as the songs before 2008 and before the crash. It's just really interesting listening to like the change in music as well, and how it kind of like that moment changed, like not even strip club culture, but just like club culture in general and the partying culture in general.
That's, I didn't even like think about that. I mean, I noted the music changes, but I like that to show the progression of what happened through the music is like, you know, that had to have been a deliberate choice, and it's a good one.
I mean, it's like interesting because you have like, again, a moment of the Usher song, and then it ends with like Lorde's anti-party anthem. It's just, I like that choice. And there's something that I've noticed that was mentioned on, oh my God, the Big Picture podcast a lot by Amanda Dobbins, where she talks about how a lot of female movies that are made for women tend to have really bad soundtracks for some odd reason. And this is like one where I was like, oh my God, I love this soundtrack. I actually, this is the music I listen to or hear like on the streets. And it felt very rare where you get a movie that is good, that's about women, that feels different than everything else that's out there, that feels new and exciting, that's not just like Ghostbusters, but what if women? And
right.
I mean, this is kind of like Scorsese, but what if women? But it's still a highly original story that's taken from real life. And then you, on top of it, you have good music. So yeah. Like someone cared.
Absolutely. And you know, I can't speak to, you know, because I sadly haven't seen a lot of those, like if they're referring to like a lot of comedies like that, like a lot, for example, like I can't think of a good specific example, but some of the trailers that played for this movie that are programmed to, I guess, an audience that thinks that they think will like these movies, if the movies themselves are an indication that yes, there's bad music played in them for sure.
Yeah, it just was really nice seeing that. And I did notice that in relation to time. And I think that it's interesting because like, I feel like I've seen a lot of these movies, and I'm thinking of The Big Short kind of specifically, this would be a good like double feature with that.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and also noted too, you know, speaking of The Big Short, this was produced by Adam McKay and Will Ferrell through their Gary Sanchez production. Who we should say are, like, you know, thankfully backing super interesting projects like this and Succession, which is...
Oh my God, yes.
Yes, so it's like, you know, just kudos all the way around to everybody who worked on this. But yeah, I agree. This would be a terrific double feature with The Big Short. Makes me want to rewatch that movie. It's been a second.
Oh my God, I like that movie so much.
I do too, for sure. Well, do we have any other thoughts on Hustlers before we start to wrap this episode up?
My only other thought would be, I understand why Constance Wu is now first billed, but still, J-Lo has been working for so long. How do you get above her billing? How do you get above her billing?
The only thing
her name is worth so much.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. I think the only thing I could think of to kind of tie it back to some opening awards chatter on this episode is if they're going to commit category fraud and submit her for supporting, even though she's very much a lead in this movie. But
yeah, I mean, she's like barely supporting. And I think that supporting and lead is so, especially in a movie like this, which is kind of very ensemble-y.
Right.
It's so hard. And there's such a thin line. Like, I feel like, yes, Constance Wu might have like 15 minutes extra and it's technically her story, but how is J-Lo not a lead in this film?
I would agree. Like I said, she's the one who comes on screen and just commands the thing, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, cool. No, I like this. I liked this movie quite a bit. I'm very glad that I got to see it. I'm glad that it's doing insanely well. I believe as of today, it just crossed 100 million worldwide, and I think it's made over 80 in the States, and it will definitely cross 100 million. So, that's a nice surprise, and I'm glad to see it doing super well.
So there's still hope in the movie industry.
Yeah. Oh, yes, there is still some hope. well, before we wrap this up, a couple other movies in September that I saw that you haven't got to see yet. I did see Ad Astra, the latest film from James Gray, which I know you've been sick and it's really bugging you that you haven't seen it yet, but
yes,
I'm not going to talk too much about it because, our friends over the Be Real podcast did do an episode to it, which I recommend listeners go check that out. It is very good, but, all I'll say is it's one of my favorite movies of the year, like hands down. I had no idea what to expect going into it. You know, that somebody gave James Gray $80 to $100 million to make a space epic that's super introspective. But I was surprised in the best possible way. I also think Brad Pitt's just having a hell of a year, too. Like, someone who I've always loved, but some of his performances as of late have been good, but he's been able to sort of like coast a little bit on his stardom. But I think both this and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, he's doing some of the best work of his career, just hands down. So, what?
I'm so jealous.
It's still out in theaters.
This is true.
So no, go out and see it. See it on the biggest screen you can too, because it's a gorgeous movie as to be expected, but it's really really unique. So I recommend that. The other movie I got a chance to see, I actually saw it months and months ago at South by Southwest, is this movie, The Day Shall Come, which it is out on VOD currently, and I think it's in limited release, but it is on VOD. It is the latest film from Chris Morris, who did Four Lions back in 2008-09, somewhere in there. You know, that dark political comedy, and just like that, this is also a very dark political comedy about an improvised preacher who's kind of like made into a martyr by the government. It's funny, but it's one of those that by the end of the movie you feel really 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 bad for laughing through the entire time, because it like it hooks you in with its sort of like madcap Mel Brooksy type comedy, and then it pulls the rug out from under you and it's just brutally heartbreaking. Like, there's a tagline at the beginning of the movie that says this is based on 100 true stories. And I believe it. I believe every one of them, and it's like deeply, deeply upsetting and sad. So I cautiously recommend it because I think it is a good movie, but like it's also becomes not an easy watch by the end. But it is very funny too. So I don't know. It's a tough balance for sure.
Yeah, I wanted to see that at South by, but I never got the chance to.
Well, it's readily available on iTunes and all the places, which I'm both, I don't know, you know, I guess we talked a little bit about distribution, so we could keep that going for just a second. I'm both surprised because just given how well received Four Lions was at the time, that maybe this would have had like a small platform release and then a VOD. I didn't think it was going to be a day and date sort of thing, but
That's what everyone goes for now.
I know the landscape's changing so much that it's like, I totally understand. Cause this movie is like, you know, if my opinion or feelings about this movie is like conflicting, like it's understandably so that they're like, well, how the fuck do we sell this movie? So we'll put it on the VOD and hopefully someone checks it out. So I totally get it for sure. Any other thoughts on Fantastic Fest, the movies we discussed, or any other movies in September that you might have watched that I haven't seen that you want to give a shout out before we wrap this episode up?
I don't think I've actually seen many new releases outside of the Fantastic Fest movies and the movies we talked about. I'm really lame this September.
I mean, not really. There hasn't been much out.
Like... I did see one thing.
Oh, okay.
Shoot. I saw The Gangster, the Cop, and the Devil. I know that that came out earlier this year in Austin, but then it played again in Alamo Drafthouse. It's a Wellgo release.
Okay.
South Korean gangster film, kind of a comedy where a gangster and a cop have to work together to solve this serial killer murder. And it's, you know what? It's not great, but it's kind of nice to finally see. I mean, I've seen a few of these before, but it's just nice to always watch like a basic South Korean gangster film where it's like, it's not groundbreaking. It's just fun. And you can be like, and popcorn-y and sometimes hilarious, but a little bit too long. And I watched that and I thought it was fine.
Well, awesome. I mean, it's just like First Love in that way, right? Of just like, this is
First Love's better.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah, it's funnier. Gangster, Cop, and the Devil. The problem is I was angry that, like, the serial killer was really stupid in the movie, but the gangster and the cop were really good, and I just wanted more of that at the end of the day.
Got it. Well, yeah. Fair enough. And I was going to say, you're not lame, because, like, I'm sure, you know, there were a ton of indie movies that made their way out through September, but as far as like wide releases are concerned, like I think we pretty much covered, like it is pretty slim pickings here in September. I mean, they had the Goldfinch, which neither of us saw.
Did anyone see?
It had like one of the worst openings in 2000 theaters, so nobody saw that. Downton Abbey is doing very well, but I have never watched an episode of the series, so I didn't really have the drive to go see the movie. Have you watched that show at all?
Which show? Sorry.
Downton Abbey.
Oh, yeah, I have. Of course I have. I really want to see the movie.
You what?
I really want to see the movie, actually.
Oh, got it. Well, and that's, I mean, we didn't cover it here, or at least I didn't, because I've never seen an episode of the series. So I'm sure the movie's good. I just have not made it there. Rambo last
I'm sure it's good for fans of the series. Oh, that's a thing.
Yeah, and that's what it seems to be. Rambo Last Blood. I watched the Rambo movies kind of in anticipation of this, but I don't really like any of them except First Blood, so I haven't been compelled to go see this latest one.
It looks bad.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but bad things about it. And then Abominable came out this last weekend, the DreamWorks film, which I've heard is fine, but I have not seen it.
I didn't realize that was DreamWorks.
Yeah, it is a DreamWorks movie.
Oh.
I guess looking at the September releases, I know this episode's a little loose in structure, but, you know, that's totally okay. One thing I would shout out, something that you and I have both seen, but we saw a long time ago, and I forgot that it did come out this September to general audiences, is One Cut of the Dead. Which is on Shudder.
Oh, yeah. It's a cute movie.
It is a really cute movie. But, like, you know, you saw it at Fantastic Fest last year. I saw it on a Delta flight because they have the deal with international films a lot of the times that they end up on in-flight movies. So, you know, we both seen the movie a minute ago, but it is out. It is on Shudder. I don't want to say too much because I think I think there's some nice surprises for people if you go in as cold as possible. But it is a lot of fun. And it's so hard to do a zombie comedy nowadays. So it's refreshing that somebody did one that was not only good, but in a way that no one's really done it before. So I would recommend that one.
No one has really done it in the way that One Cut of the Dead does, which is nice.
Agreed. Cool. Well, we've been jabbering for quite some time. I think we could probably safe to say we can wrap this up. Jenny, thank you for taking the time, as always, to come on the show. Always love when you come on the show to talk. Where can people find more of your work online?
You can find me over at the Austin Chronicle, where I will now be a semi-contributor.
Awesome. That's awesome. Congratulations.
Semi-regular. Sorry, I forgot that word. That's an important word, right?
Not... it's semi-contributor. I think we get the gist. That's so awesome. Congratulations.
I am taking a Twitter break, though. But if you want to follow me, you can find me at JennyLeeX33 as well.
As you should. We all should, really. If it wasn't for the fact that I'm, you know, trying to get all this work out there, I would be taking a break as well, because it is hell on earth on a daily basis. So
really the nicest thing I've done to myself this week.
You know what? You have to do self-care, right? Like, that, it has to happen. And that's honestly a good, easy gateway to, like, further self-care, is to just stay off Twitter.
Honestly, it was just a way for me to read more and, like, do other things instead of, like, sitting and going through Twitter on my phone.
It's why I waste way too much time on that.
So site. Addictive.
I agree. But speaking of that hell site, you could follow me there at Ryolie90. That's Ryolie90. And once again, the Discourse is a part of the Playlist Podcast Network. So if you enjoy this show, be sure to subscribe to us via your podcatcher of choice, be it SoundCloud, Stitcher, Anchor FM, iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, which we are now on. You will get this show as well as our other programs, including The Fourth Wall, Indie Beat, Be Real, and any of the other things that pop up on our feed from time to time. I was going to say next week episode, but you're getting two this week because we've been so backed up. More like tomorrow's episode after this drops. We will be discussing Joker. Chris Evangelista from Slash Film will be joining me to discuss that. So strap in for maximum discourse, because it will happen. So, but thank you to our listeners. Thank you for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode. Everybody's like crystal, Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash. We don't care. We aren't caught up in your love affair, and we'll never be royal. It's a one in our blood. That kind of love just ain't for us. We crave a different kind of buzz. Let me be your